7th. President Representative Taylor Barnes, Navarre & Son Chair. We're going to try to move through some bills that have relatively little controversy here so we can get some out. And the ones that have a lot of testimony will come up in the second or third. But I want to start with Senate Bill 78. This is an act relating to unauthorized use of handicapped parking. It's a pretty simple bill. It says that if you have a handicapped parking or disabled handicapped person sticker or special permit, that on your death you have to return it to the department. And also puts a $100 fine in place for parking in a handicapped designated zone in Alaska. Now, a lot of municipalities, I think Ketchikan and others, already have that, but this is in all the rest of the state. And Beth, if you want to identify yourself and make some comments, and there's one proposed amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Beth Vitula, and I'm volunteer counsel to Senator Vitula. You explained the biggest portion of the bill. The bill was introduced to close a loophole in the law that exists right now, and that is in unincorporated areas or some municipalities there aren't any fines for parking in a handicapped parking spot. So this puts in place that it would be an infraction anywhere from $100 up to $300 for parking in a handicapped parking spot. Upon the death of the person who got the permit, it would revert back to the department. The other thing that it does is it plugs in reciprocity with other states and other nations so that our people who have handicapped licenses can park in other states and likewise their people can park in Alaska. There's one amendment, and it was suggested from the Department of DMV. And it's a technical thing that got dropped out. It was in the original bill and came through the Senate with it. And that is on line 19, after AS 28.10.495, there needs to be a new insertion to add back in the fact that the department can also issue special license plates. We've got the permit language, now we need to add back in the language to allow them to issue their license plates. So that would be, I would ask that the committee consider that amendment to it, since we would foreclose the department from issuing the license plates if we drop it out of this bill.
Chairman.
Representative Taylor.
I move, do we have the bill before us now for purposes of amendment? The
bill's before us.
Okay, then I would move amendment to, as suggested in the copy. It isn't numbered, but it's here in front of us.
Representative Cotton's here, it's amendment number one. So that, I'm just trying to read through the sentence. Does that still read right, even after we get this in?
While you're figuring that out, Mr. Chairman, could I ask a question up there?
Oh, okay, I guess. Is there any objection to amendment number one? Hearing none, that's adopted. We're on 78. Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's when a person is temporarily handicapped or injured. Can they get a temporary permit? And does that have an expiration date on it, or is it renewable, or...
Thank you. Through the chair, yes, you can go to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and if you have a doctor's certificate, they'll give you a temporary permit. I think it does have a six-month run, but they'll be happy to extend it for anyone, and they do that routinely. So they'll give you, that's the difference between a permit and the regular tag. Thank you.
Any other questions for Beth? Representative Taylor?
I move the bill's individual recommendations.
Motion to move House CS for CS for Senate Bill 78. Amended by Judiciary. Any objections?
Thank you.
Hearing
very,
none,
very
bill
much.
Moves. Senate Bill 1, the bill, an act relating to the rights of physically and mentally disabled. We have quite a few people there to testify. I'd like Representative Miller, if you would
Mr. Chairman,
join us there.
I'll be glad to join at the table. Senator Duncan's staff is here, and she's probably the most knowledgeable on this. Give a brief summary.
Either one. I was just going to volunteer that if you want to send your best spokesman forward, we could probably get this bill out in the next 5 minutes here. And I thought you had familiarity with it from last year, so whichever you want to do. Or both of you.
Join me up here, Walker, kick me if I say anything.
This bill, just to give the history on it, went through the House last year, went through the Senate. I think it made it almost to the Senate calendar on the closing days of the session. And didn't quite make it, and I believe the vote in the House was, it wasn't 39-0, it was 40-0 or something like that. So, Representative Miller, if you want to give us a history of it.
Mr. Chairman, I don't really need to say an awful lot more than that. It's a bill that just recognizes the civil rights of the physically and mentally handicapped. You're right, this is virtually the same bill. Maybe a few words here or there are changed, but it's virtually the same bill that passed this House and all the committees in the other House to which it was assigned. It's long overdue for some reason or other. It's it hasn't passed for the last 3 years, but it's, I don't know of a single agency person or group that thinks it's anything except an excellent bill. It just sets out in statute what probably most of us think is the case anyway, but as a matter of fact, it's not. It needs to be set in statute that people with physical disabilities or mental disabilities have the same rights to use the streets, to use the public buildings, to use the facilities of the state of Alaska.
Okay, Roxanne, did you have anything you want to add to that? Or? Okay. Representative Taylor?
I know that Representative Grunberg and I worked long and hard on this legislation, held all kinds of hearings last year in the Hess Committee, and I think the testimony is strongly supportive of what this witness has testified to also, and I really support him on it. I'd like to be the one moving this bill with individual recommendations.
Is there any other questions or of the committee? Anybody else? Representative Cotton?
I just apologize for not being as familiar with this legislation as probably everybody else appears to be, but Section 1 discusses juror responsibilities and suggests that a person who isn't able to hear or see shouldn't be disqualified from serving on a jury. And I just wonder what sort of problems that might bring up. Has there been any discussion? I assume that doesn't mean hearing and or.
No, let's go through the chair. That has had a lot of discussion, both in the Senate and last year. And this, just collectively speaking, as a last year's legislature, we just decided that that's not a great problem. That there would be interpreters there for the deaf, and in those rare cases where seeing is a vital part of the process of being an adequate juror, for instance, that the attorneys have sufficient number of peremptory challenges. One thing, another that. You know, that's just not a problem, but that you know, 99 9/10% of the time, that's not an impediment to an impartial jury judgment. In fact, some would argue that, in a very real sense, it might even be an enhancement because they, for various reasons. I guess I don't need to go into right now, but we just decided last year it was not a problem. I think that's what the decision has been this year as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I just note for the record that we do have an interpreter here in the committee room with us right now. So, Representative Grunberg, I know you worked on this bill long and hard, and you've had a lot of thoughts. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, I understand that it's fine with me.
Okay. There's a motion to move committee substitute for House Bill 1 from the committee.
Senate
Bill 1. Mm-hmm. Is there any objection? Hearing none, I'll move that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, sure.
The list we have, House Bill 28, it's been before the committee.
Which one?
House Bill 28.
Good.
With their proposed committee substitute should be in your file.
Mr. Chairman, I move we adopt the Levy 5-4 committee substitute.
Motion to adopt committee substitute for House Bill 28, Judiciary, the 5487 version. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the committee substitute is adopted. Max, did you work on this? You
know? Yeah, it looks fine to me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Taylor.
Yeah, I just had a question for the prime sponsor, then the co-sponsor, Mr. Grunberg, that if in fact this is enacted into law, can we take that as some warranty that problems in Spinard will be cleaned up shortly?
Yeah, we actually were going to add Hyder in here too, but
good.
We couldn't find an appropriate
support.
Place.
Take care of the shady lake.
I just have to, for the purposes of bringing up a discussion, I'm sure that will hit the floor. I got to raise the line 2425. That
I wouldn't talk about raising an issue on this one.
The reimbursement of state for actual costs incurred by the court system. I just note that so everybody can see that on there. I'm not sure which way it goes. I have no particular heartburn on it.
We just wanted to be sure it was revenue neutral in the governmental sense.
Any objection to the bill amendments? Max?
I move
it. Full of smirks today.
After this morning, we need all the help we can get.
House Bill 28, Judiciary, with individual recommendations.
We appreciate the courtesy.
Is there any objection? None. Votes. House Bill 198. Representative Hoffman, there's several people here to testify on this, and we have about 6 minutes to roll.
It is 198.
We also have House Bill 256 and 224, and I just want to let people know the intention. We have a full day tomorrow with some testimony that's been lined out for quite a while, so all of these bills will be carried till Saturday morning at 8:30. But I would like to get testimony from those people who are not going to be here Saturday morning.
Mr. Chairman, I had one question, if I may. We had House Bill 256 about the James Dalton Highway.
Yeah.
That's been hanging around. What are we going to do with that?
Whatever you want to do.
I had an amendment I was working on that one.
Are you still working on it?
Okay, let's get it out of here on Saturday then. If you have some amendments, let's get them ready. But there's been people on 198 that have been down for a couple of days to try to get some testimony, so perhaps we could take those who have to leave now. Representative Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 198 is the primary intent is to try to limit liability on private lands. And it also has a provision in it that could make those lands available for recreational use. And instead of getting into it much further, we do have two individuals here today that have traveled from Anchorage. Larry Kimball, the land manager of AFN, and Elizabeth DeLong, from the planner, from plans director for the Chilista Corporation, and I've asked them to make a brief presentation to the committee to make the committee informed on this piece of legislation.
Appreciate it. You're welcome to join us here, Representative Hoffman. If both of you want to come up at the same time, you're more than welcome to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lawrence Kimball. I serve as the land manager for the Alaska Federation of Natives, coordinate the land activities of the 12 regional corporations, and in that capacity sit as a staff member on the Alaska Land Use Council also. What I'd like to do, appropriate here, is give you a little bit of background where this is about the end of a three-year effort on this bill by a multitude of agencies and individual private landowning interests. And then Elizabeth, who did a fair amount of the drafting of this legislation to assist with any of the section-by-section analysis. Briefly, a few years ago, when the state started to acquire its land from the federal government, its 103 million acres, and the Alaska Native Land Settlement took another 44 million acres into private ownership, we began to look at serious trespass problems. The federal government reserved easements across those lands, both state and federal. The state reserved easements. They were unmarked. They're unsurveyed lands for the most part. The trespass situation that was there was one of pretty much not enforceable. There was some criminal trespass in terms of damages to properties. The Public Safety, Department of Public Safety in 1981 did a study which concluded that the problem was going to get worse, that the Alaska Land Use Council had the committee functions and the makeup that they could attack this problem and take a look at it. In addition, the council did put together a group that was consisted of state agencies, particularly DNR and Fish and Game, and the land managing agencies from the federal government, which is Wildlife Service, National Parks, Forest Service, and BLM. Along with the Native community, we generated what was called a trespass abatement recommendations. Looking at the problem, it was not a problem that we felt could be cured by simply going out and want to prosecute everybody that walks across lands. It was impossible with large tracts, remote locations. The statutes were in no way adequate for a private property owner of that magnitude to even mark their lands or give notice of trespass in any reasonable way. We also decided that the best way to approach it was more in a transitional and an educational sense. We know that over a period of time, 10 or 20 years, people who were using federal land freely, people who were subject to very few regulations in terms of use, would begin to get educated that this thing was now private land. And as private land, there were certain rights that had to be retained by those landowners. The approach that we took in the abatement recommendations was more of an educational approach to it. We have recommended a series of things that state and federal agencies, along with private owners, can do to provide information on private lands, where they are, trespass laws, things that are allowed, not allowed, where use permits can be acquired, that sort of thing. We've also joint ventured on several things. One, for example, is what we call an easement atlas that Department of Natural Resources, along with the Bristol Bay Native Corporation and BLM, have combined for publication to identify all the easements across those lands, what their uses are. Most of them are Section 17B easements from the federal government across Native lands. What we've tried to do is identify where access is to these areas that might be used consistently for hunting and fishing. When we began to look at the Land Use Council's recommendations, they did indicate one of their recommendations that legislation was needed at state level, that in fact the current laws were not adequate to protect private property rights, and they didn't feel as though the Land Use Council was in a position, though, to develop a piece of legislation. So out of that generated another work committee, which was the producer of this bill. We took, again, the same approach that was recommended by the Land Use Council, and that was one of trying to find a way to mitigate the problem as opposed to going out and prosecuting everyone. And what we've come up with is the research of about 27 states down south that have, out of 43, that have adopted a Model Recreational Use Act. What it basically does is it allows the use of those lands for any kinds of recreational purposes, and in exchange the liabilities that a typical common law are taken away. Now, it doesn't take them all away. It doesn't take the malicious act away or liability. It also, the bill primarily looks at and identifies a couple types of trespass which are common up here. They are specifically put in the bill in Section 5 as an educational tool. Again, we have many people out there trespassing that say, no, we're not, and they don't know what the reason is. They don't know that it really is a trespass. Of course, the other thing does, Section 6 and 7 define a notice section, which allows a notification that the prosecuting attorneys tell us would be more reasonable in terms of prosecuting anyone on criminal trespass of that type. That's just a very brief look at the background of it and the intent of it. And Elizabeth can go through those sections and give you more detailed information.
Please proceed there, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Elizabeth LeBlanc, and I'm the Plans Director for Chulista Corporation's Land and Natural Resources Department. One of the things when looking at trespass and liability and the various problems associated with land management was we found that in a legal sense, trespass is a very difficult concept to define and legislate. In Alaska, there has not been a lot of case law dealing with the problems of trespass on private land and what happens to a landowner in those circumstances should he be sued because somebody's hurt. As a result, we found that the private landowner, whether you be a homesteader, a person with a fish camp, or a native corporation, is exposed all the time to problems with trespassers and liability suits resulting from somebody hurt while they're using your land, either intentionally or unintentionally. So that was kind of the philosophy that went into looking at what kind of laws could we implement to remove some of the liability problems and also give the landowner certain protections and still give the public what they want, which is the right to go out and use land as they see fit, especially for recreational purposes. Section 1, which is probably the bulk of the bill, deals with opening private land to recreational use. What happens is a private landowner, if this goes through, would allow somebody to come onto his land as long as he's doing some sort of a recreational activity, and in exchange for that, the person cannot sue the landowner if he's hurt. The exception is if the landowner acts in a willful or malicious manner. In other words, if you go string a cable across your road and somebody drives into it, and you did it on purpose, you would still be held liable in that situation. But let's say you've got a gravel pit, or somebody's built a cabin, or has left something on your property you don't know about, somebody's out hunting or camping and they're hurt, and they would not be able to sue in those instances. The...
No. Go ahead, Representative Taylor.
Yeah, thank you. You premised your remarks by talking about a lot of suits. Can you tell me what amount of suits we're really talking about here for trespass? Because in 20 years up here, I don't think I've seen but one or two, and they were trespass where somebody had effectively marked their property and someone was coming, like landlord-tenant stuff, that kind of thing. But I've
right now, there have not been a lot of suits dealing with trespass on private land. The potential, we think, is very high because there is now so much private land that is now in ownership. There's so much land in private ownership. You've got at least 44 million acres of land that is going to be privately owned just by Native corporations. In addition, you've got a lot of the land that the state has transferred to people for homesteads, remote cabin parcels, agricultural land, the large farm tracts out in the interior. And these are all parcels that people are still using, the public's using, and the potential we feel is very high. All it's going to take is one or two instances of the public finding out that they can sue if they're hurt. And I think there's a real high risk.
Well, I guess that's the question I'm asking is, right now, under the common law and under the law of trespass in this state, they're not suing because they don't have a right to sue.
The right is there, but at the same time, unless you're posted, the landowner's really not protected. The only kind of situation he's protected is if the land is unimproved and apparently unused, or if there are improvements on the land, such as you've got an airstrip, or you've got a gravel pit, or you've got a cabin, and somebody's hurt using those. If on your land as a private landowner, a person could sue you, and it doesn't matter what he was doing. Even if
he has to show negligence on my part before he can sue me and recover under the civil laws of the state.
It'll be comparative negligence.
Well, he has to show some negligence on my part, not the mere fact that I own the land and that he was injured upon my land. He has to show some degree of negligence on my part.
Okay.
That's why. I'm really trying to find out what's the basis for.
I'm just going to let him get through the testimony here, and I'm willing to stay here. If other committee members usually have to leave at 3, but I'll stay here until we get through the testimony here anyway. And if other members have to leave, we're going to be back on this on Saturday morning. So go ahead.
Okay. So Section 1 looks at the private landowner and relieves him of some of the responsibility in exchange for owning his land. Section 2 addresses a new form of trespass, which we're finding is occurring more and more frequently in Alaska, and it's been commonly called geophysical trespass. There have been several instances in the state. So far, none have been prosecuted. We've negotiated out of court with the parties that are doing it, where exploration companies come onto private land, they do illegal exploration work, they take data, and then the consequence is the landowner is put in an unfair bargaining position when it comes time to sell his exploration rights. That mining or oil company either knows the land is worthless or valuable, and we don't necessarily have access to that data. Up here, it is quite common for exploration rights to be sold. And with people going out and doing this kind of activity, the landowner is deprived quite often from an opportunity just to sell his exploration rights. And that was the logic behind identifying this new form.
Could you run that by me one more time?
That's what I'm trying to figure out, too.
Okay.
Somebody trespasses on your property and finds some geological or geophysical data.
What is happening? I'll give an example of what happened. We had an instance of a mining company going onto regional corporation land, gathering data, taking rocks and samples, and then coming back and approaching us for a deal. And in doing that, they had some sense of what the value of the land was. We had no access to the data, so we were put in an unfair bargaining position. We didn't know if the land was worthless or not worthless. They had some sense of what the value was. We didn't have a legal right to the data because they weren't supposed to have been on the land anyway, and they were denying they were out there. We found out they had been out there because somebody found their oil drums. There have been a couple other regional corporations that have had those instances where a mining company or an oil company goes onto the land, takes geologic data, and then tries to negotiate a deal.
How does that fit into House Bill 41?
It's different. They're trespassing and taking it illegally. It would be the same if they hauled a drilling rig out there and banned
it. So in the state's instance, we're giving exploration rights to go do it. We're telling them to go do it, but we still don't get the data.
Well, the AOGGC gets it, but the...
But the people in the state who bid the land out don't get access to it.
Right.
So the state... I'm just trying
but
to...
See, it's different there because you're talking about on a lease. If you lease a piece of ground from the state, you drill all the holes on it.
That's your data. You paid for it.
That's yours. But what the question on 41 is, it's the adjacent property. So if you have a lease, you want to drill right up on the line so you can see what's over on the other land, then you have the advantage when you bid on that other land. That's what 41's all about.
Okay. I'm sorry, just we have a big battle going on in getting the state getting access to some of this type of data too, so I understand your frustration, right? Try to cut a deal with somebody who knows what's going on.
Very hard.
Yeah, but before you cut the deal with them, go find out.
It's very expensive.
Well, sure, that's what the other guy paid for too.
Well, when you're an oil company or mining company, your budget for that sort of thing is much greater than some small native corporation.
You don't have to sign the deal.
No, you don't. But at the same time, if we're finding that in this kind of setting, that word of mouth goes very quickly. If you're not willing to negotiate, they can badmouth you in such a way that people don't think your land is worth anything. It makes it difficult for you to do a deal, if you have good data.
It's very similar to negotiating with you, Representative Taylor, on the deal, and I jump into your law office and rummage through your files and find your contract, right, and then I run back outside.
Or if he finds out you don't really have a case. And that's what they're concerned about, too. They may have a dry hole there, and they don't want the guy to know about it. They'd assume lease the land and make him pay to come in and drill.
There is another situation.
I mean, isn't it the buyer? Okay, the buyer
I didn't want to get this bogged down. I wanted to get through the bill, so go ahead, Larry.
Very briefly, when exploration companies were doing drilling and testing and trying to identify what the geological bases were up in the north of the Chukot Sea, they had, in fact, I know this because I was working on St. Lawrence Island at the time, they had information from the Russian side and they had information from the Siut Peninsula side. What they needed, what apparently was a key to finding out or determining, and this was before it went out to bid, they sent a team out with helicopters to land on St. Lawrence Island, which is private surface and subsurface, and fee simple, as best as you can get, and spent 10 days out there before the villagers suddenly realized they were there, collecting information to put that geological formation together, and then simply came in and walked off with it. Never did anything. I mean, the corporations never got any benefit from it at all. And the St. Lawrence Island is a fairly large island, with the exception of two villages, pretty remote. So that can happen, and that wasn't, in fact, taking of information that helped that company bid.
Okay, so this section here, if I read it, if they enter the land, take the data, they're liable for treble damages. And if they were there inadvertently or had probable cause to believe that the land was the defendant's own, then it's only actual damages. Okay. Just so I understand what the section says. Maybe we should probably skip through the rest of the bill, Representative Taylor.
When we're talking about damages, what are we talking about? The leaving the oil drums and disturbing the tundra?
No, whatever's provable. The monetary loss in terms of your lost lease and potential revenue. There are substantial case law supporting these kind of damages in the lower 48 in oil and gas exploration situations and for mining situations. It's a financial loss to that company or to that individual landowner. The damage to the land...
Maybe it's a game. They discover something, isn't it?
It could be, but it's usually not used in that way. Most of the damage to the land, the physical damage is minimal. That's why they look at what is the financial impact on the company.
Why are we once again, I don't know where this has come from, but years ago somebody put in a statute up here about cutting down your neighbor's tree, that was worth treble damage. It's the only place it showed up. Now in this last year, this is the second bill we've seen asking for treble damages again. I don't understand the need for treble damage.
Well, but I think this is basically an interference of contract type situation. It's almost a Texaco Pennzoil type issue. And I think that's what's trying to get at. And then we can get into the measure of damages here later. But okay, we'll just try to get through the bill.
Okay. Sections 3 and 4 have very simple amendments that clarify existing statutes in terms of what is improved or unimproved land, and then recognizes that a trespasser should not have a right to sue if he's harmed. Section 5 is a clarification of what constitutes various forms of trespass in Alaska. As Larry mentioned, the intent of this section was to educate rather than come up with different kinds of trespass that would be people would be prosecuted for. And then finally, Section 6 is a clarification of the posting law in the state. Right now, the posting requirement is very vague, very hard to comply with, and if you don't comply with it and you have problems with trespass, you cannot get enforcement. So by outlining what exactly is posting, we hope to eliminate a lot of the enforcement and prosecution problems. And that's basically the bill.
And what, I'm sorry, what was the definition of improved property?
Improved is basically clarification in terms of, there's a definition in the state statutes right now as to what constitutes improved property, and that would still apply.
We're not talking about buildings in downtown Anchorage.
No, we're talking about a gravel pit or a road that you don't know about out in the middle of nowhere.
So it doesn't involve structures?
Not necessarily.
Only if it was related to something that was out there, a gravel pit or perhaps some, could be a mining operation possibly that somebody didn't know about was there. This does not pertain to the urban area necessarily. So it wouldn't include homes or...
I haven't read 795, so I'm not real sure, but how does it distinguish between the urban and non-urban? I'm just trying to get... Yeah. There's always the close case, right? I mean, the Surrey office building's not included, but you get out in the unimproved land and you run into a cabin, right, or some type of development. And somebody gets hurt walking up the stairs or collapses, the door falls on them. I'm just trying
that
to...
That was not intended. I'm not sure that I can answer that because it was not intended to...
But the intent was not to apply to an urban situation. It wasn't supposed to give you a defense where something happened in your backyard. So I think we have to look into how to make some sort of distinction in that case.
Well, some village corporation land is in the village, right?
Right.
I mean, it's how do you distinguish the unimproved village land from the improved village land? They have an office building at the outskirts of town. I mean, I'm just trying to think through some of this. Cape Fox Corporation in Ketchikan, for one thing, has land up, what's the lake up there? The ice skating, the recreational lake. We go up above.
Where?
No, on up.
Lake Connell.
Harriet Hunt, yeah, that's all Cape Fox land.
Yeah, right.
They logged a lot of that and the road going in there, and people go up and ice skate there and ski in the winter. And I can see they don't want civil liability in that, but they also own land out at Saxman where they have their office building, which is kind of on the edge of town. And I think they ought to be liable for any damages that occur in that building.
We agree too, and I think that's a technical change.
Maybe that requires
be corrected.
A definition.
Okay. I wanted to know whether in your task force you'd address that type of issue or something, or we could get the benefit of some of the thinking that had gone on in that.
The philosophy behind most of the bill is to deal with the rural setting. When you're out hiking someplace and you don't necessarily know whose land you're on. In some cases it may be the state. In some cases it may be private, and stepping one foot either way is going to put you on somebody else's land. And by looking more at most of the trespass going on up here is recreational in nature, in the sense it happens when people are hiking or camping or fishing or just skiing generally out, doing things they've been used to doing all along because so much of the land had been federal land. Suddenly it's now private, and that landowner is subject to a lot of responsibility. And there's nothing to stop somebody from killing somebody, and you might have a sympathetic jury that day that decides to go with the person that was injured. And
don't do it in Ketchikan. There aren't any sympathetic juries anymore. But I guess I'd raise the issue Representative Taylor raised early. You still have to prove negligence, and you still have to prove that you acted in some negligent fashion, or the defendant is in some negligent fashion before you're going to collect anything. And there's always that degree of comparative negligence. There's the airstrip with the gully in the middle of it routine, right? There's the road with the cable across it. A lot of those types of issues. But just pure unimproved land hiking across it, I just cannot imagine that you're responsible for the foxhole in the ground. It just doesn't come in.
My concern is, I don't understand, and maybe since they've researched it, they might, but how has the liability changed in any way from what liability that was out there for the federal government under the Federal Park Claims Act the entire time that we're talking about going through that issue? And if this land was sitting on federal land, it had improvements, it had bear traps on it, it had all kinds of other things out there. Under the Federal Tort Claims Act, the same rights of trespass for damages for negligence on the part of the federal government. We're always there. You've already told us there aren't any suits. I guess my concern is, I don't understand how come we have to have a special law for native-owned land, rural, as opposed to...
This isn't just native-owned land. This is applying across the board.
That's where the concern's coming from.
I know, but this applies to everybody's land.
I agree, and I mean, there's some pretty major land holdings around here in Southeastern when you look at all these old patented claims. And the amount of private property there was out there with old cannery sites and mines and everything else. And we've survived real well with the common law of the state of Alaska. We didn't need treble damages, and we didn't need a Class A misdemeanor for somebody that happened to step onto another guy's land in the process. If I'm hunting on Admiralty Island for deer, and I happen to walk across the corner of some old cannery site, this means I can be thrown in jail for a year and fined $5,000. If I mess around on that land and I pick up a rock sample, now we're looking at treble damages on top of it. I think the law has been more than adequate in taking care of the responsibilities of the property owner for years in the state, and we don't really need to go into this because there's no demonstrated difficulty yet. We may need something about these mineralogical people running around grabbing data.
Where's this business about going to jail for stepping over the line?
Section 2, but pumps it up to a Class A misdemeanor. That seems kind of hard.
Yesterday, in talking with a couple of the staff aides,
Section 2,
it was pointed out to us that was probably an inappropriate type of punishment for the situation we were looking at, and that in amending the bill, it should be bumped down to a much lesser crime. We were not aware at the time how that basically we're dumping trespass in with this serious types of assault and things, so that's a technical error on our part.
We have a
remaining title 9.
Section 2 or 5?
2.
2.
5 may also have it, but 2 certainly does.
Section 2.
I don't see it in Section 2 of the bill.
I must be.
Oh, is that Title 9?
Yeah.
Oh, it's because it's in Title 9.
Yeah,
it?
It's falling within a category of offense.
Oh,
and Section 5.
And Section 5.
But we have the word willfully in Section 5. That's always it. That's an inside joke you won't understand on the committee, but...
Well, we've been told that joke, so we understand it.
Somewhere between intentionally and knowingly and willingly. Okay, is there any other comments that you want to make? What's your schedule, Larry? You're going back to Anchorage?
Yeah, so we have, I have to go back to Land Use Council meetings tomorrow.
Okay, would you be available on Saturday for a teleconference if we hooked it up?
Certainly.
Okay, we'll be probably meeting between 8:30 and about 11. We can get a time more specific than that,
Bill,
but I'd like to have you be able to participate on this.
Sure.
Okay, is there any other questions? Okay. I will work on this bill between now and Saturday and see where we're at. I think I understand some of the issues, and I appreciate your comments. I think this bill has been here before. I recognize it in some way, shape, or fashion, but the issue has been around. And I think for the committee members, we had a bill in last year, I think it was Clarkson's Cabins Bill,
right,
where we addressed a lot of those liability questions that were cabins on state lands, and instead of the land, the state tearing the cabin down, that we're going to just take them over and put them into the public use category. The issue came up of the state's liability for these cabins since we didn't build them, and if somebody walked in and tripped on the porch and fell through, are we going to get sued? And I'll get staff to dig out the research and comments on it, but it's a lot of the same type of questions that you have here. So we'll hold that over till Saturday morning. And for the committee, we have 3 bills on the agenda tomorrow, but I would assume that Senate Bill 22 is going to take a majority of the committee time. That's the bill that right now the wholesale power rate is under the structure of APUC, and that's the bill dealing with that. So with that, the committee is adjourned.